Welcome to this third and final 2011-12 PLMD podcast, completing the series of PLMD preparation, submission and calculation of the benefits for the 2011-12 PLMDs. This podcast will deal with the calculation of the value of the expense payment or benefit in kind, which is known as the cash equivalent of the amounts to be reported. It may assist you to have a copy of the 2011-12 Form P11D to refer to as we go through the different sections. To begin with, I can confirm that the only change to the P11D for 2011-12 is the year itself, and also that the official rate of interest and the average rate of interest for beneficial loans remained at 4% throughout the tax year 2011-12. Please remember that when calculating the cash equivalent of any P11D expense payment or benefit in kind, the value must include VAT, and it does not matter if the employer is able to recover any or all of the VAT paid. I also need to remind you to complete all the boxes for those sections where an entry is required, including the cost, market value, the amount made good or from which tax was deducted, the cash equivalent, and most definitely the description boxes. Please also note that if the amount made good or from which tax was deducted entry results in a minus figure, you should enter zero, not the minus figure. So for example, if we have a cost of the benefit of £230 and the amount made good by the employee was £240, the net result would be minus £10, but we would enter a zero in the box on the P11D. HMRC provides six P11D working sheets to help us calculate the amount to be reported, and as I go through the sections of the P11D where these are available, I will tell you about them. But for now, let me point out that Working Sheet 1 is for living accommodation. Working Sheet 2 is for car and fuel benefits. Working Sheet 3 is for company vans. Working Sheet 4 for interest-free loans. Working Sheet 5 is for relocation expenses and benefits. And finally, Working Sheet 6 is for mileage allowance and passenger payments. I should also remind you at this time that the entries on the P11Ds, for example, box 15 in section M, match the entries on the self-assessment tax returns. Section 2, providing copies of the forms. It should be noted that there is a statutory requirement to provide employees with a copy of the P11D information by the same 6th of July 2012 deadline. Any employee who was employed on the 5th of April 2012 is entitled to receive details of the information being reported on their 2011-12 form P11D or P9D. A copy of the information must be supplied by the 6th of July 2012. The employer has the right to choose the format in which the information is provided. So that could be a photocopy of the P11D or P9D. It could be information sent by an email or a company memo. The software that I use provides employee advice notes that are, in fact, very good for giving to employees. It is acceptable to deliver photocopies of the original P11Ds by hand, by post, and it is permissible to send an electronic version, providing confidentiality is guaranteed and the recipient as a means of downloading the document and printing it off. Employees should be reminded to keep their copies safe, as the information on the P11D or P9D may become an essential part of the information required when completing a self-assessment tax return. If an employee loses the P11D or P9D and requests a copy, the employer is obliged to supply a copy within 30 days of the date of the request. Where an employee leaves the employment after 5th of April 2012 and before the 6th of July 2012, it may be necessary to post a copy of the form P11D or P9D to the employee's last known mailing address. Employees who left during the 2011-12 tax year may need the P11D or P9D information for their self-assessment tax return and may ask their former employer to provide the information. Again, employers are obliged to supply a copy by the later of the 6th of July following the end of the tax year in which the employee left, or within 30 days after they request the information. If an ex-employee doesn't request a copy, an employer should keep a copy available for them up to the end of the third tax year following the end of the 2011-12 tax year. And this mirrors the pay-as-you-earn record-keeping requirement of 3 years plus the current year. Next section, calculating the value to be reported for sections A to E of the P11D. In this section, we need to ensure that we report the expense payment of benefits in kind in the correct box on the P11D. And let me again remind you about HMRC's CWG5 booklet and Appendix 1 Common Benefits, where you will get some very good assistance in determining what entry is required on the P11D. The first section of the P11D is Section A for Assets Transferred. And if you look at the P11D, it refers to cars, property, goods, or other asset. This is a brown box section where we have to report the market value of any company asset transferred to the director or employee. The general rule applies if the asset sold or transferred was a car or any other asset that had never been used to provide a benefit. A common error is to report the book value of the company car instead of the market value, which may well be higher. And I will always advise that we need some evidence of the market value, particularly for more expensive assets. If a company asset was previously made available as a benefit in kind, the cash equivalent will be the higher of the market value of the asset at the date of transfer, or the market value of the asset when first provided as a benefit to the employee, less any sums already taxed on the use of the asset. That special anti-avoidance rule doesn't apply to company cars. Let me give you an example. We have an asset which originally cost £1,200, and in the first year of it being made available to the employee, he or she would have been taxed on 20% or £240, leaving a net amount untaxed of £960. If the market value of the asset when sold to the employee, say on the 6th of April 2011, was £800, the value to report would be the higher figure of £960, not the market value. And that's because it's an anti-avoidance measure and relates to asset that was previously provided as a benefit. Now, the next section is Section B, which is payments made on behalf of the employee. It's a blue box section where potentially there could be a Class 1 NIC liability. We have to report any payments made by the employer on behalf of the employee, and the amount of any tax deductible on notional payments not immediately borne by the director or employee and not made good within 90 days of the receipt of each notional payment. Payment made on behalf of the employee could be something like a garage servicing bill, where the employee arranges with the garage to service his car, but the employer makes the payment direct to the garage, and there would be a liability, including a Class 1 liability. Next section is Section C for vouchers and credit cards. This you will see is a blue box section, so potentially a Class 1 NIC liability if there is any NIC liability. We have to report any expenses incurred in the provision of vouchers capable of being exchanged for money, goods or services, and also any additional expenses incurred in providing the particular benefit. If an employer buys a large number of vouchers and purchases them at a discount, we would report the cost to the employer, in other words, the discounted value. If the employer was to purchase vouchers and there was an additional charge, a commission or admin charge, we would report the cost including the commission or admin charge. So we are reporting on the cost basis. We should exclude the value of any vouchers to which pay-as-you-earn was applied, which could perhaps be luncheon vouchers, because it's a common occurrence for employers to pay luncheon vouchers through the payroll, excluding the 15 pence exempt amount. We do not have to report the first £55 per week or £243 per month of any qualifying childcare vouchers provided by the employer. If more than the exempt amount was to be given to the employees, say, £60 a week, the excess of £5 a week or £260 per annum would be reported here. Now, we have a change for childcare benefit in respect of any employee or director joining the employer scheme after the 5th of April 2011. And this is where tax relief has now been restricted to the basic rate of tax, but only for someone joining the scheme after 5th of April 2011. Any existing members of the scheme at that date would continue to enjoy full tax relief, whether that is at 20% basic rate, 40% higher rate, or the 50% additional rate of tax. But for new members to the scheme joining on or after the 6th of April 2011, a higher rate taxpayer will not have relief on £55 per week, but instead will be restricted to £28 per week. And we would have to report the excess of, say, 52 weeks at £27 per week, in other words, £1,404 as a benefit in kind. If we have any additional rate, 50% employees or directors claiming the tax relief, again, it's restricted to basic rate, so they only get £22 a week, and we would have to report the excess of, say, 52 weeks at £33 or £1,716. Childcare vouchers are reported year, but amounts would be reported at Section M if the employer was to contract directly with a provider of childcare and the restriction applied. The next section is Section D for living accommodation, and here we have the first of the working sheets that may be of use to you if you're not using software to prepare the P11Ds. So working sheet one. And again, it's a brown box, so Class 1A NICs liability arises. There is a basic charge based on the greater of the annual gross rateable value of the property or the rent paid by the employer. And from that, we must deduct any rent paid by the employee. The benefit will be adjusted on a pro rata basis if the accommodation was only available for part of the year. We then have a second charge, or what is known as an additional charge, on property costing more than £75,000. And that figure of £70,000 has to take into account the cost of any improvements to the property that were incurred in the previous year. So costs incurred in 2010-11 would be added to the value to count for the 2011-12 year. Where the cost of the accommodation, including any improvements, exceeds the £75,000 limit, the excess has to be converted into an annual rent by multiplying that excess by the official rate of interest at the start of the tax year. In other words, at the 6th of April 2011 for 2011-12. That was 4%. So by way of example, if we had a £475,000 property, we take off the £75,000, and then the additional benefit would be £400,000 at 4%, in other words, £16,000, which would be reported in addition to any rent charge or the gross rateable value. The value of any exempt job-related accommodation, such as a house or flat occupied by a school caretaker or a housemaster in an independent boarding school, may be excluded providing the exemption conditions are satisfied. The conditions are, firstly, that it's necessary for the proper performance of the employee's duties that he or she should reside in the accommodation. The next one relates to property which is provided for the better performance of the duties, and it is customary for employers to provide accommodation. And the final one is where there's a special threat to the employee's or director's security and arrangements are in force to provide accommodation for that purpose. And it's only the third leg that could apply to a director. So a director could not live in exempt accommodation if it was for the proper performance or better performance, but the exemption could apply to a director living in accommodation provided for security purposes. We also have to remember that there may be other taxable benefits related to the provision of the accommodation, even if it happens to be exempt. That could be the use of furniture, it could be the cost of decorations, or even if the employer were to pay for the cost of heating and lighting of the accommodation, that would be another taxable benefit and to be reported elsewhere. The next section on the P11D is section E, which is for mileage allowance and passenger payments. And here we have working sheet number 6 that's available to do the calculations if you need it. It is a blue box section, which means that potentially there could be a Class 1 NIC liability. We are required to report any excess over and above the authorised or approved mileage allowance payments, and that limit is 45 pence per mile for the first 10,000 business miles, reduced to 25p per mile for any additional business mileage over 10,000. For mileage allowance payments, the approved number is the number of business miles travelled other than as a passenger multiplied by the appropriate rate for the kind of vehicle used. The question to be asked is whether or not the employer has a system in place to check if any director or employee has exceeded the tax relief available. So did anyone get 45 pence a mile for more than 10,000 business miles? Or did anyone get more than 45 pence a mile for any of the miles involved? For Class 1 NIC purposes, 45p is the limit for all the mileage, so no 10,000 restriction there. For passenger payments, the approved amount is the number of business miles travelled by a car or van where a passenger is carried on a business journey, and in respect of which passenger payments are made by the employer. The employer can pay up to 5 pence per mile tax-free to cover passengers on necessary business journeys. Next section of the P11D, I want to calculate the values to report it at sections F to N. And section F, of course, is one of the major ones. It relates to cars and car fuel benefit. It's a brown box section again, and we have working sheet number 2 to assist us with the calculations if we need it. Employers must provide details of cars made available for private use and report the total car benefit charge. A car benefit charge is incurred whenever a car is made available without any transfer of the property in it to an employee or to a member of the employee's family or household, where it is by reason of the employment and is available for private use. The information that we have to report on the P11D is first of all the make and model of the company car, the date the car was first registered, and we have to provide the approved CO2 emission figures if there are any. We need to report the engine size and the type of fuel power used, as well as the dates the car was available for private use. For 2011-12, we have some significant changes because we now only have 3 letters to describe the cars to be reported. Firstly, we have letter E for electric cars, and these are reported as previously. Then we have letter D, which now applies to all diesel cars, where previously we had 2 types of diesels, D and L. Now we only have 1 type of diesel car, and the letter to report is a D. Then letter A covers all other types of cars, where previously we had types H, B, C, G, and P, but there are no longer any reductions for alternative fuels. And the other point to note here is that the diesel surcharge will now apply to all diesel cars whenever it was registered. So if you have a look in the 480 booklet, you will find details of the fuel power key. So we have E for zero emission cars, including electric cars, D for diesel cars of all standards where a 3% supplement must be applied within the 35% maximum, and then A for all other cars. And I should make a note here that this includes hybrid diesels. So a hybrid diesel is not a fully diesel car, and therefore it's an A, not a D. Another significant change for 2011-12 is that the £80,000 cap that previously applied for expensive vehicles is no longer relevant. So if we have an expensive car, it will be taxed at its full list price. And by way of an example, for the previous year, 2010-11, if we would have a car that was with a list price of £120,000, assuming it's a 35% CO2 emission car, it would have been taxed at only £80,000 times 35%, given a benefit for 2010-11 of £28,000. But because of the change that's been brought in, if the list price is £120,000 and the CO2 figure is 35%, for 2011-12, the car benefit to be reported would be £42,000 compared to the £28,000 benefit previously reported. The government has announced some special arrangements for cars which are specially equipped for security purposes, because these can be very expensive, but I doubt that any of us will deal with any such car. In terms of the CO2 emissions, we have the normal or the lower CO2 threshold of 15%, which starts at 121 grams per kilometre. But the lowest appropriate percentage is 0% for cars like electric cars, which emit 0% emissions. If a car has CO2 emissions of less than 76 grams per kilometre, the appropriate percentage is 5%. And for cars between 76 grams per kilometre up to 120 grams per kilometre, we have an appropriate percentage of 10%. After that, the rate is 15%, increasing by 1% for every 5 grams per kilometre up to the maximum of 35%. That would apply to emissions of 225 grams per kilometre or above. If you're doing this manually, you can look at Appendix 2 of the booklet 480, the 2012 version, which you can access on HMRC's website, and that will give you a list of all the CO2 emissions. Now, the important point about cars and car fuel benefit, and this is part of the quality standard issue, is that we only use the boxes when the cars are first provided or they cease to be provided. So there would be no requirement to enter the 6th of April start date or the 5th of April finish date unless the car was first provided on the 6th of April or was taken away on the 5th of April. So any car that you're reporting on the 2011-12 P11D that the employer director had on the 5th of April 2011 and still had on the 6th of April 2012, you will report the details of the car, but you will not make any entry for the dates that the car was available. If a car is off the road for a period of at least 30 consecutive days and a replacement car is not provided, we would have to reflect that on the P11D to effectively show the dates the car was unavailable. But most of the time when cars are off the road, even for long periods of time because of mechanical problems or a road accident, the employer or the leasing company is going to provide replacement car, and therefore we probably have nothing to do other than report the original car for the whole of the year. Cars will not be treated as unavailable if an employee is banned from driving, or even if the employee is out of the country on business or holiday and the period extends beyond 30 days, because the car is available for their private use. It's important to note that the list price is the inclusive price published by the manufacturer, importer or distributor if sold singly in a retail sale in the open market in the UK. And the legislation says on the day before the date of the car's first registration. This price includes VAT, car tax, customs or excise duties and delivery charges, but it excludes the new car registration fee, which is an admin charge. When we report in the list price of each company car, we have to include standard accessories plus a list price of all non-standard accessories provided after the car was first provided. We can, however, ignore later provided accessories if the cost for the accessory was below £100. So, for example, someone has a set of mud flaps fitted on a car after it's been delivered, maybe cost £60 or £80. That will be ignored because it's less than £100. Very importantly, the list price is the prices I've stated, and it's not the price paid for the car. So we ignore any discounts. Second-hand price is totally irrelevant. We would want the original list price of a second-hand car. We are allowed to use the manual price for an automatic car that's provided to a disabled employee, and I can refer you to booklet 480, paragraph 12.7 for some guidance on that. Although we see it very rarely nowadays, capital contributions made by an employee up to a maximum of £5,000 can be used to reduce the list price of the car. So, for example, if an employee was to request a tow bar be fitted to their company car so that they can tow their caravan, and the employer required the employee to make good the cost of the tow bar, we might see the list price increased by, for argument's sake, a £250 cost of a tow bar, and the employee paying that £250, which would be regarded as a capital contribution, reducing the list price back to its price without the tow bar. If an employee or director is required to make a private use contribution towards the more expensive cost of running a company car, that will reduce the car benefit on a pound-for-pound basis. But there must be a requirement to make payments as a condition of the car being available for private use. The payments must be specifically for private use. And so payments for supplies or services such as paying for petrol or insurance will not qualify as a private use contribution. And I would warn that HMRC are going to look at the paperwork and challenge any doubtful adjustments. A car fuel benefit charge will apply if any fuel is provided for a company car, unless the employee is required to and does make good the full cost of any private fuel, or unless fuel is only made available for business mileage. And of course, the important point is that can be proven. The business mileage records will have to stack up. Employees can make good the cost of all private fuel by payment or reinstatement, but employers may have to prove to HMRC employer compliance officers that procedures have been in place to ensure that no free fuel has been provided intentionally or otherwise. For 2011-12, the company car fuel benefit multiplier has been increased from £18,000 to £18,800, increasing the cost of the benefit to employees and directors. So for a 35% company car, the fuel benefit has increased from £18,000 at 35%, or £6,300, up to £18,800 times 35%, which is £6,580. Quite important, if we're doing this through a Excel spreadsheet or PLMD schedule, in other words, doing it manually as opposed to using PLMD software, to make sure we change those figures.